Gentlemen, my name is Michael Duchenne. I'm Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you to another lecture as part of Einstein Fest, and very pleased to welcome David Rowe this afternoon. David is spending a few days with us, lectured this past week on mathematics, and will be back again with us twice tomorrow, once for a lecture and once as part of our Bistro Banter series at 4 o'clock. So we're putting him to work, and delighted to have him with us. David Rowe studied mathematics and history of science at the University of Oklahoma and took a second doctorate in history at the Graduate Center of the City University, New York. He served as book review editor, managing editor, and editor of the journal Historia Mathematica. In 1992, David Rowe was appointed professor of history of mathematics and natural sciences at the Johannes Gutenberg University in Mainz, Germany, where he presently teaches. His research has mainly focused on mathematics, but in recent years he has been concerned with Einstein's general theory of relativity and the broader cultural and political impact of Einstein's ideas. As part of this effort, he and Robert Shulman, who spoke this morning and will speak again tomorrow, have co-edited a source book entitled The Political Einstein, Private Thoughts and Public Passions, scheduled for publication by Princeton University Press in 2006. We're very pleased to have him with us. Please welcome David Rowe.
Thank you, Michael. So this talk is going to cover a little bit of the technical developments involved in Einstein's rise to fame, but largely the popular end of that. And I'd like to show how these things crisscross in a way, also with politics. So the idea here is that you get the flavor not of independent moving events, but in fact a complex sort of story of interaction in culture. And I'll begin with the roots of Einstein's fame in England. To do that, though, we need to jump over to Brazil for a moment. The 29th of May, 1919. The English historian Paul Johnson, in a very acclaimed study of modern times, that's the title of the book, I think, a huge study of modernity in the 20th century, begins his whole book by saying that it was on this date that modern history began. And in fact, he uses this as a thread all the way through relativity in the 20th century. So I won't be doing anything nearly so ambitious here, of course, but we should, of course, allude to these famous eclipse expeditions of the British. There were two of them, actually. So the telescopes that you see here with the mirrors, the two mirrors for reflecting the light, were set up in Sobral. And these were, the larger of the two was in fact to be the main instrument to collect data. Well, they were lucky with the weather that day. There was a lot of sun, but they neglected then to cover the mirrors. And what they learned after taking then the photographs is that the larger mirror distorted due to the heat, and so the data was worthless from that particular instrument. They had to use the smaller of the two, and even it was affected to some degree. So they needed data from the second location off the island, or off the coast of West Africa, the island of Principe, in order to salvage this whole effort. Well, this brings in the famous name of Arthur Stanley Eddington, who was surely England's leading pro-relativist. In fact, he's the one who was engaged in this project from the beginning. And it's interesting that politics already played a role in this case, because he was a Quaker and a pacifist, and the Astronomer Royal of England, Frank Dyson, was worried that if he were called up to service, of course, he would have declined and ended up embarrassing the entire British establishment by being thrown in prison. So they think up a nice project for Eddington. He is then going to be put in charge of working out these eclipse results. And his writings about this space-time and gravitation from 1920 are still wonderful reading today, so I can recommend them to you for that part of the story. But what's not so well known is that Eddington beforehand, before the eclipse takes place, writes a report on the relativity theory of gravitation. And this is reviewed 2 months before the eclipse expeditions take place in the British journal Nature. I just want to read you some passages from that where you'll see right away that this theme of relativity and relativism, this general sort of cultural theme, already pops up in a certain respect in this report or in this review of Eddington's report. There's a certain misgiving somehow that the writer expresses here. What can one say about a theory that surpasses Newton's wonderful accomplishments by assuming the complete relativity of time and space? While we are amazed by this magisterial theory and by its grasp of a till now unrecognized conceptual unity, some difficult questions still remain. If this dream of complete relativity is really true, then we approach a point of such generality that we lose touch with ordinary experience. The new law of gravitation lacks the astonishing simplicity that characterizes Newton's law of gravitation. Generalization is the highest intellectual accomplishment, but perhaps it leaves us thirsting for particularity and simplicity. Eddington's report on what is certainly the most remarkable publication during the war leaves us reflecting about the direction in which the greatest satisfaction lies. The reference there to the most remarkable publication of the war is, of course, Einstein's own work that Eddington learned about, but not firsthand. Of course, it's during wartime. He learns about it through contacts in Holland. I'll mention those a little bit later. Well, let's address here then a general question right off. In what sense was Einstein's theory of relativity really revolutionary? This theme of revolution pops up in the press right away. The British make the famous announcement on the 6th of November, 1919, confirming that Einstein's prediction of the deflection of light beams in the neighborhood of the sun is correct. And so his theory seems to be confirmed. How does the press deal with that? Well, in England, you have the famous headline, Revolution in Science, Einstein versus Newton. And then a quote from the article itself. Lively topic in the House of Commons yesterday, and Sir Joseph Larmor, a physicist, said he had been besieged by inquiries as to whether Newton had been cast down and Cambridge done in. Well, Einstein actually reacts to what's going on, all this discussion about Newton versus Einstein, and writes an article on the 28th of November, 1919, distancing himself from this sort of talk. He writes, "No one must think that Newton's great creation can be overthrown in any real sense by this or any other theory. His clear and wide ideas will forever retain their significance as the foundation on which our modern conceptions of physics have been built." That's in England. Now turning to the United States, you have in the New York Times banner headlines a few days later, "Lights all askew in the heavens, men of science more or less agog over results of eclipse observations. Einstein theory triumphs, stars are not where they seemed or were calculated to be. But nobody need worry." And then comes this famous theme, "A book for 12 wise men. No more in all the world could comprehend it," said Einstein when his daring publishers accepted it. There's an English version of this story involving Eddington, who's told that the story's going around, only 3 people in the world can understand it. And then Eddington just stands there, and the person wonders, why he's not saying anything. "Well, surely, Arthur, you shouldn't be so modest." And Eddington replied, "Oh, don't worry, I'm not being modest. I'm just trying to think who the third person could be." Well, this business about how esoteric and difficult relativity theory is or was perceived to be ought to be set against the fact that Einstein himself wrote a book for the layman about relativity theory, the special and general theory of relativity, already in 1917. And of course, there's a huge success with this book after 1919, so it goes through 14 editions in about 5 years. And it's a really canonical book, in a way. This is the book practically everybody back then read, and the famous thought experiments involving train cars and light signals are all here to be seen. So this is, if you're going to talk about a broader relativity revolution, an absolutely paradigmatic text. And here you see the kind of longer-term influence, the Philip Glass opera from the 1980s, Einstein on the beach, and train cars, and light and bullets, and things like this are, of course, setting up images that are familiar to us from any of these sort of popular accounts or semi-popular accounts. Train cars, trains, and light cones. Well, I want to mention these two things because already you can sense in this popular literature and Einstein's own book a sort of differentiation between these two types of things. The image on the left, of course, is the original Einsteinian type of thought experiment. The one on the right is already a bit more abstract. Light cones are actually structures in Minkowski space. So this is this four-dimensional space-time. And on Thursday, in fact, someone asked me about how much mathematics did Einstein really need in order to do relativity theory. The more precise answer I couldn't give at the time, but I think what I have to say here maybe clarifies this point a bit. Because, of course, you can combine images. So this is how you can look at a moving train on a platform or look from the train's point of view, put that in Minkowski space and explain the Lorentz contractions and so forth. But what's interesting is that in this booklet from 1917, Einstein does not use any of this Minkowski space stuff at all. And in all his works, these at this time anyway, space-time diagrams are virtually absent. So this already suggests that there's a differentiation of reception here and development. But he writes about Minkowski's ideas in this booklet from 1917. He says that without Minkowski, the fundamental ideas behind the general theory of relativity might have remained in diapers. You simply can't do his theory without four space, so you start with Minkowski space in order to do it. Nevertheless, he writes further, that these ideas of Minkowski are not needed for an understanding of the grounding ideas behind either special or general relativity. So this is how Einstein presented this, and this suggested, of course, to many that you could understand the basic ideas of relativity theory with high school math, so to speak. And that's what Einstein writes in this book. He even presents, of course, these three classical tests, the 1915, from November 1915, he had changed the value of this light deflection, the first of these. So the angle becomes a double value of 1.75 minutes of arc. The other result from 1915 is this very delicate calculation involving the perihelion of Mercury, 43 seconds of arc per century involved there. These are these three classical tests he discusses in his popular book. The crudest test, in a way, from the point of view of theory, is the redshift, gravitational redshift. If that turned out to be false, that would have meant that, in fact, the special theory would have been contradicted. So he can explain, at least in layman's terms, what this is all about as crucial tests of the theory. But what probably gets lost a bit in the background is the ideas of Ernst Mach. So I just want to suggest that all along, there's a richer tradition of critique of Newton's ideas that comes from Mach, who's a huge figure of that time period. And Mach, of course, pondered the origins of inertia, and he suggested that inertia was, in fact, not inherent in bodies, but was, in fact, due to some kind of mysterious interaction from distant masses. And this is a huge source of inspiration for Einstein. You can see it already in an early work from 1912. So this, he's playing around with gravitation and inertia here, but he does not yet have the ideas of general relativity. He's trying to implement this Machian program. Is there a gravitational effect analogous to electrodynamic induction? Field theory, a big model. And he predicts frame dragging back in this situation. The picture that you see here is essentially the model he was dealing with. You could think of this as localized, a hollow shell, and that's a test particle in the inside. The shell rotates, and you try to determine whether or not there's any kind of inertial effect on that test particle. So you could conceive of that more locally or as the whole cosmos. But this is, in fact, a set of ideas that then sort of falls out of the picture. Einstein does not work on this topic again in this time period. It's Hans Thiering in 1918 who takes it up and applies Einstein's ideas to this. So this is one of the elements leading to a whole bunch of things which I'll just call conceptual confusion that take place at this time period when people are trying to understand the basic concepts which Einstein says are actually accessible to anyone who knows a little bit of high school math. E.E. Cummings commenting on this in his famous poem, space being, don't forget to remember, curved, is picking up on actually some of the wild talk of the days about this very topic. An old idea, in fact, if space is curved, that meant to most people that it sits inside of some larger four-dimensional spatial configuration. Curvature, naively, would suggest that, the very word. And this was, in fact, one of the and on Thursday I talked about Euclidean geometry and how dominant that was. Everyone thought of Euclidean geometry as the only possible structure for space. And here comes Einstein saying, space is curved. Well, how's it going to be curved unless there's another fourth spatial dimension, which, of course, his theory does not say at all. And mystics, of course, loved to talk about the fourth dimension, so this was already very much in the culture well before Einstein. His comment on this was, mysticism is the only criticism people can't level against my theory. Well, just to make it a little bit clear what curvature isn't, Einstein had originally, it has not to do with the simple deflection of light around the sun or some massive particle, a massive body. Already back in 1911, he had predicted on the basis this value here, the so-called half value of deflection. He had worked out on the basis of his equivalence principle, and this takes place in a so-called flat spacetime in Minkowski space. So there's no curvature, spatial curvature necessary here to calculate this at all. Now, very few people picked up on the fact that this was actually a major thing for Eddington and others who were working on this. So when this theme of Newton versus Einstein really comes up, Eddington is thickly involved in this in November 1915. That's the time period when Einstein develops the new value. He calculates the double value of the bending of a beam of arc. But Eddington notices that there's a possibility in Newtonian theory of doing this, and in fact Newton himself writes about it in the first query to his optics. And then Eddington liked to use the phrase, light has weight. So Newton says so. And he dubs then the half value that Einstein had calculated in 1911 the Newtonian value. And that means that when he goes off to Principe, he's after a sort of two-pronged test. The one possibility is the top one, which is that
the full deflection predicted by Einstein in 1915 will take place. Another possibility is that the so-called Newtonian half value will be found. Of course, the third possibility is they won't find anything at all. And what are we talking about here? These are really tiny gravitational effects. If you want to imagine what we're measuring, then you remove yourself about a kilometer from where I'm standing, and I'll hold up a cherry between my fingers, and you try to measure that angle from a kilometer away. That's the full value that you'd get. If you want to get the cherry pit, that would be the half value. So these are very precise measurements, and this distinction was really seems to have been lost at the time, not surprisingly, unless you read someone like Eddington carefully. Now let me talk about the situation in Germany here very quickly. First of all, the boom of interest in relativity is well documented. You can see it by just calculating the number of publications in Germany, books on relativity, and you see this big spike after the war, after 1919. Hubert Gernau, who compiled these statistics, nicely broke them down for our purposes here into books by pro-relativists, show a somewhat similar pattern, and anti-relativists, people who are writing against the theory. And of course, the patterns, the overall patterns, are somewhat similar. You can see the relative contributions of the two types. The only thing that's quite interesting, I think, is that in Germany, after 1930, the anti-relativists already have the upper hand in terms of the number of publications. So they are picking up on things, which are, of course, politically charged here. A pro-relativist, a leading pro-relativist, was the editor of the counterpart to the British journal Nature, Die Naturwissenschaften, edited by Arnold Berliner, printed all kinds of reviews and things about relativity theory, and he once wrote to the philosopher Hans Reichenbach, "I think you must next time write an article about the inadequacy and incompetence of the people who are now busy popularizing relativity theory, whether by lectures, articles, or brochures. Most of these popularizers naturally acquired their wisdom from some kind of popularized brochures, as it is clear that they cannot read Einstein's original works, and one should really put a stop to what these people are doing." Well, who is he talking about? In the margins of that letter, he writes various names, and he ends with one name three times. Moshkovsky, Moshkovsky, Moshkovsky. He's really upset about Moshkovsky. So who was that? Well, he was a freelance journalist, and unfortunately, he was also a personal friend of Einstein. He wrote all kinds of books about science, Jewish jokes, and so forth, and he plays a very interesting role in launching Einstein's fame in the German context. So he meets with Einstein, has conversations with Einstein, and one of the first things he publishes, and notice the date, please, October 1919, he's learned from Einstein about preliminary findings, not published yet, this is before the official announcement, preliminary findings that seem to suggest that indeed the theory of general relativity will be confirmed by the British. What does our journalist friend Moshkovsky do with that information? Well, he goes, of course, straight to the papers, and in Berliner Tageblatt, publishes on the son's answer. "She was asked, she gave her answer, and the echo of her oracle will resound through the centuries. We people of today still stand too close to the event itself to measure its wide-reaching significance. The astonishment over this message from the son will have no end," and on and on and on, citing Kant and Goethe and all of it. But that's Moshkovsky. Einstein enjoyed the guy, but he was very embarrassed by this and published a tiny little retraction, in a way, just clarifying what he had heard in a telegram from Lorentz about this. Then comes the publication, Conversations with Einstein. This is the ad for it, again, in this very kind of exotic language. And
Max Born's wife sees this ad and writes to Einstein immediately. She's scandalized that if this book should come out, this will ruin him forever. All his enemies will have so much firepower now because Einstein's friend has published some crazy book with allegedly citing what Einstein thinks about everything in the world. So she demanded that that he withdraw permission to publish, and he did try to do that. In fact, he writes to Mashkovsky, but it's too late. In fact, the book comes out, over 60,000 copies are sold in the first year. The scandal, however, that Hedy Born imagined never came to pass, and Einstein with his friend Ehrenfest enjoyed a chuckle about this whole episode. But of course, it's one of several things involving journalism and the popular press that happen at this time that will, with time, build up a certain momentum of their own and lead to difficulties. Well, talking about Weimar culture, there are so many different things you can talk about here, but a theme that comes up that Peter Gay wrote about long ago, the outsider is insider, I think applies rather nicely to Einstein as well. When he comes to Berlin, he's, as Robert Schumann described, he's very much the outsider at that point. And then being in Berlin, in the position he's in, and after the First World War, he's thrust into the inside. And so what's interesting is, of course, how does he react in that new situation when he's famous, scientifically famous, but everything is very, very fragile politically and so forth. So this time in Berlin, of course, is very, very famous. It's the capital of a new, distinctly modern culture, modern architecture. You think of the Bauhaus. You think of expressionism in film, avant-garde art and literature. But also, at a more mundane level, as a sort of, in certain circles, celebration of a fast-paced city life, experimental lifestyles, cars, planes, and a zest or jest for life. And it's an international trend, of course, that has to do with modernity. And its counterpart in the United States is the Roaring Twenties, but without prohibition. Well, how does Einstein fit into this? In a lot of the literature, he's mentioned, but I think there's a lot more that can be said. So we'll begin with a famous building, the Einstein Tower near Potsdam, which one can still visit today. The idea of a man named Erwin Freundlich, who was one of the very first scientists or astronomers who had an interest in confirming Einstein's theory, but it was difficult to get support for that at all, and so it takes this British breakthrough in order for all of a sudden the money to flow, and Freundlich sets up then a foundation, and they gather money and build this Einstein Turm. The Einstein Turm was set up, in fact, for a very specific scientific purpose, but it was advertised in the wider culture through this well-read publication, Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung. This is what it looked like when it was completed in 1921. The scientific purpose was this third test I mentioned, the most crucial, actually, from a theoretical perspective, test of all three, gravitational redshift. And so the idea here was simple enough to see that here around the building is this tower, and light beams are reflected around mirrors and so forth. There's a diffraction grating here, and then through that it's reflected back here to a camera, which then takes pictures in order to try to sort out from the sun's light, tries to sort out whether or not there's this phenomenon of gravitational redshift. Well, there was competition, of course, to make this sort of finding, which was very difficult, and the competitor at Caltech, Mount Wilson's tower, turned out to be taller. It's architecturally not so spectacular, of course, but it's for scientific purposes, it was a more important place for this sort of thing. And Einstein goes to Caltech, as Robert mentioned at the beginning of his talk. He's there for three different visits,
from 1930 to 1933, so he got to know these things very well. So scientifically, this doesn't go anywhere. Politically, it doesn't go very nicely either. Of course, after 1933, you see Einstein symbolically swept from the tower, which is renamed, of course. And for Freundlich, it didn't go so well either, because it was obligatory then to give the Heil Hitler Gruß, the Nazi salute, and he lost his job when he refused to go along with that. But Mendelssohn's career was not hurt by this at all. This is the first of many buildings then in which he received contracts, and he has a rather spectacular career then as an architect. Of course, he's also Jewish and has to leave Germany in 1933. One of his buildings then is the redesigned Ufa Film Theater in Berlin, where weekly newsreels were shown. And of course, this is the era of famous films. If you go today to Potsdamer Platz, you'll see a film museum there where they have nice reproductions of sets from these famous films of the era. Certainly, well, we're seeing, and you'll see things like this, posters advertising the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Metropolis, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, these famous, famous films. What they won't tell you about, of course, is another film of the era, the Einstein film, advertised here with somewhat similar calligraphy. And this citation comes from an advertisement about telling us why people want to know about the theory. What would attract people to want to see a film like this? What accounts for the public fascination with Einstein's theory? He has shaken our customary perception and made us feel insecure on this spot of earth that seems so firmly anchored. This insecurity explains the longing to understand these ideas that have overturned the world. And of course, you see the typical images again in this film of train cars and clocks and so forth. But not everyone was so fond of this film. You see here a review from 1922, Kino Rat, the film of physical nihilism. Einstein creates a universe using the imperfection of our sensory perception. He preaches to us, all your perceptions are relative. Therefore, you must construct a relative universe following my recipe. That is nothing but the most unproductive nihilism, and in accordance with the political past of the professor, who belongs to political parties that seek to relativize the national sense of honor, all Einsteinians with their comprehension simulating Bolshevist Zionist clique cannot deny the fact that time, space, and matter exist infinitely, and that from a given center one can indeed develop an absolute worldview. Well, I think a quotation like that makes it clear in certain circles that not everyone was willing to somehow accept that there might be a scientific theory that they couldn't quite understand that had some validity outside of politics. It's all very politicized, and of course, 1922, Robert mentioned it in his talk, is the year that Walter Rathenau is murdered. This is the spot in the Königsallee where he was shot in his car. I call him here a Prussianized Jew. He's, in fact, one of those very assimilated, or striving to assimilate, let's say, Jews of the period. So a very, very different sensibility than Einstein's own. And in fact, Einstein had urged him to resign his post as foreign minister. He thought it was inappropriate for a Jew to take on a position of such responsibility in such precarious times when political assassination was a very, very commonplace thing. It started on the far left and moved more and more toward the moderate to liberal side of things. And so after this, Einstein himself is on hit lists, and he has to withdraw from the public arena. He travels abroad. Luckily, he had invitations already to go to Japan and so forth.
But he writes about Rathenau the following: "I regretted that he became foreign minister. Given the attitude of a great portion of the educated segment of German society toward the Jews, I am convinced that the natural stance of Jews should be to distance themselves from public affairs. I hadn't imagined that hatred, delusion, and ingratitude could have gone so far." Rathenau, by the way, was a critical figure in the whole German war effort, because he was the one who basically arranged for the whole supply system in the economy to work. So he was a Prussian Jew in the sense that he was, of course, very dedicated to the German cause, including during the war. So, and then Einstein writes, "To those, however, who have led the ethical upbringing of the German people for the last 50 years, I would like to call out, by their fruits shall ye know them." Well, a friend of Walter Rathenau, the journalist Maximilian Harden, was shot then only weeks afterward and barely survived, died a few years later from his wounds, and testified in court that Einstein, who was then in Japan, went to Japan because he did not consider himself safe in Germany. This particular statement, you might think it's an incidental thing, but what you have to factor in is this was an official statement in the press and so forth, and Einstein is, for the Weimar Republic, something like a diplomat abroad, an unofficial diplomat, bearing witness to the new Germany, the new Weimar culture. And you can see that very easily by looking at the files kept of all his travels abroad, which more or less correspond, of course, to these hot periods in German politics at the time. So you see right after 1919, then there's all of these different entries into the Einstein file, then it moderates in the middle period and picks up in the end. So again, this pattern of politics in the Weimar period is very clear in Einstein's career. So this was a huge embarrassment, or potential embarrassment. They telegram, the Foreign Office telegrams Einstein in Japan to see if he can confirm or deny what Harden had actually said in court. But that would get us into too many details. Let's go back to culture. Dadaism, celebrating the irrational in cultural politics, a famous movement of the day. And one wouldn't expect necessarily that Einstein would show up in such a context. Dadaism comes from Zurich and then, of course, finds its way famously to Berlin. Iconoclastic, bombastic ideas, expressing very deep disillusionment with post-war culture. And in fact, you see in this famous collage from 1919, the image of Einstein embedded here in the collage. And here I mentioned already the fact that a notorious figure of the day had accused Einstein's relativity theory of representing a new form of science, a scientific Dadaism. Few people in the scientific world could comprehend these types of attacks, but here's Einstein sitting here in a collage, and Paul Weiland very likely saw this before the famous attacks began on Einstein in August 1920, because months before that in Berlin, it was on exhibition. Here's the Hannah Herk is the Künstlerin, and here is this collage. This is Raoul Hausmann next to her, one of the leading figures in the Dada movement. And of course, this comes from, not just from anywhere, this is this famous face that launched A Thousand Myths, the photo from the Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung. And I'll come to that in a moment, but Dadaism is, in fact, a sweeping attack on Weimar politically and culturally and so forth. So this is from 1919, the Dadaist gegen Weimar. they're basically against every type of bourgeois existence, of course, and they were, this particular thing circulated, this ball, a president, this Erdbaz, this is a sort of a cultural attempt to overthrow what's going on right after the Spartacist uprising and the murder of Rosa Luxemburg and Wilhelm Liebknecht. 1930, I mentioned earlier these newsreels which were shown in theaters all the time. You got your news by going to the theater and so forth, and there you could see Einstein occasionally, as on this occasion when he spoke at the German radio exhibition in August 1930. And he gives a very funny little typical Einsteinian speech on that occasion, but he holds out the hope that this new medium, radio, will somehow help overcome the political problems of the day, in particular, of course, the tensions that grew up after the Versailles Treaty between France and Germany. So this is his hope that he announces on this occasion. Here's a little quote. So verehrte An- und Abwesende, a very interesting way to address an audience in front of you and one over the airways. The technologists first made true democracy possible. Radio has a unique function to fulfill in reconciling nations. It shows them to each other in the liveliest form and mainly from an endearing side. That's a very hopeful statement, of course, in 1930. 1930 is a precarious time, and 3 years later, the speaker at the same occasion, the German radio exhibition, is Joseph Goebbels, who, of course, had a very different message about radio. Hitler happened to be present on that occasion, and radio is, of course, an important medium for the Nazis once they come to power. Well, I want to now mention some of the scientific things very, very briefly here, not to leave the wrong impression. I've been talking here now about things in the popular culture a bit, but Einstein's ideas come up in World War I, a very tricky time. Nevertheless, he quickly, through his international scientific network, receives a lot of support from key figures. I've mentioned Eddington already, but here you can see Eddington in a picture. Here he is sitting next to Lorentz, the sort of doyen of the European physics community. Here's Einstein, his friend Paul Ehrenfest. And this is the least known of the figures, but probably the most important in the story. It's the Leiden astronomer Wilhelm de Sitter. De Sitter is long interested in gravitational theory, Einstein's gravitational theory, before anyone else. And so he's following these ideas very closely. He's the one who then contacts Eddington, and he publishes, in fact, in Britain, two articles which Eddington helps, of course, get into print. And from that time forth, Eddington picks up the ball and becomes the leading figure in Britain. So you get to see just from that picture some key networks. I've myself been particularly interested in another continental network that has its hub in Göttingen, figures like Hilbert Klein and Emmy Noether. But you could look at other centers I've mentioned here. I've cited a few others. Here's a book about geometry and physics in this broader time period. Einstein, Felix Klein, Hermann Weyl, David Hilbert. These are all Göttingen figures who play into this story. And in fact, it's very, very clear if you study the history of geometry that the general theory of relativity marks a true revolution in the history of mathematics, because from this time forth, differential geometers and so forth will be pursuing the new prospects opened up not only by general relativity but unified field theories. Hermann Weyl is the most famous name in that regard, with a passion. And you'll find all kinds of interesting things. I just show you one little example from some lecture notes that Hilbert spoke for a whole year in 1916 and 17. He gave a course on relativity theory with all kinds of new things in it, including this diagram that is replicated in the first
actually standard German textbook on general relativity by Max von Laue, 1921. The diagram is just of some interest, I think, because of the name Schwarzschild, Schwarzschild solution. And here you have something called the Schwarzschild radius. These are, you can think of as light beams or geodesics in the space-time. And they stop there. They can't enter in. And you see some of them are even swung around and go out and so forth. Well, this was the way Hilbert dealt with this thing, picked up by von Laue. And in fact, all of the relativists of this time, the leading relativists, including Eddington, believed that there was a singularity there in space-time and that you couldn't penetrate inside of this Schwarzschild radius. This, of course, shows you how difficult the mathematics was, that the leading mathematicians of the day didn't realize that this is what we call an artifact of the coordinate systems used, and that, in fact, there is no singularity. That's why you have black holes. Well, here's Schwarzschild. He's another Göttingen figure. I spoke on Thursday about Gauss. There's a whole line of them, Gauss and Riemann. And in this regard, among the astronomers is Karl Schwarzschild, who made fundamental contributions then to general relativity and quantum physics before he tragically died in 1916. He was one of these Jews who was keen on showing his support for the German regime. He volunteered to be in the army, went out to the Eastern Front and contracted a skin disease which cost him his life. Max Born is another figure that has to be mentioned, who is the famous Göttingen physicist, but he was a colleague of Einstein's during the war in Berlin. And he's also important for the sort of type of work that Einstein's 1917 text represents. This is another very famous one that was now available still in print in English, this textbook of Born's on relativity theory. This is the 1920 edition, the very first edition of it. You see the publisher is Springer, and there's even a picture of Einstein that appears in it with a personal dedication from Einstein to Ferdinand Springer, one of the two leading figures here. This Springer firm is absolutely essential to understand how they fit into the picture, too. I can't talk about that here, but they're major, major players in how mathematics and physics come together during the war and afterward. The picture, though, is somewhat interesting in light of what I said earlier about the controversy over Mashkovsky's book, because when when Einstein writes Mashkovsky and tells him that he no longer wishes that it appear, there was also an issue about a photograph appearing in the book, and indeed that was the one thing that Einstein managed. No photo appears in the book. However, in the very first edition of Born's book, you have this photo and a very hagiographic little biographical sketch by Max Born. So there was a tendency on the part of these so-called friends of Einstein to write scientific books, or semi-popular scientific books, but also say personal things, which got them in a bit of trouble. And then you can understand Max Born's wife's reaction to the Mashkovsky book, because she's very concerned that he'll be linked, that her husband will be linked with similar sorts of more popular and less scientific publications. So the whole aspect of relativity for experts, of course, is a huge part of the story here, too. It's going on simultaneously. Wolfgang Pauli comes into this in a big way. He's one of the most interesting of physicists who work on this, the reception and development of relativity theory. And this is known today through the famous theory of relativity of Pauli. Originally, it was to have been a survey article written by Einstein for the German Encyclopedia in Mathematical Sciences, an operation that Felix Klein ran. Well, Einstein, as so often, I mean, is a little bit busy, and so he backs out. And Arnold Sommerfeld, who is Pauli's teacher, it's then up to him to write the article.
Well, Sommerfeld has this bright young student this semester or something named Pauli, and he says to Pauli, would you at least maybe do some literature searches and start up an article? And when he saw the first draft of what Pauli wrote, he said, oh, you do it. He just gave it to him. This became the great masterpiece of the time. We're very lucky that Einstein backed out, because no one could have written anything anywhere near as good as what Pauli did at that time. It ends with, quite amazingly, the last chapter, it's supposed to be a survey, it ends with a critique of the going unified field theories of the day. So it's a really amazing book. And in the course of this, of course, Klein and Pauli are in correspondence. And one of the things that Klein writes to Pauli has to do with this popularization. In fact, Klein has been corresponding intensely with Einstein over these years about cosmology and all kinds of things. And he writes to the young Wolfgang Pauli, Einstein is always so appealing in his personal pronouncements, in complete contrast to the ridiculous PR put in motion to honor him. So you sense there, of course, again, from the people in the know that they are displeased by all of this popularization. This takes me then here to another aspect, which is the role of the press in general. I'll have to go here rather swiftly. The so-called Jewish press of the day, Berliner Tageblatt, edited by Theodor Wolff, was the most prominent such publication, but there were a whole series of them in Berlin published by Ullstein. Ullstein had all these publications of the day, but I want to focus particularly on the Illustrierte Zeitung, because that illustrates, as the name indicates, a new approach to journalism based on photography. So they weren't humble about pronouncing their importance, Ullstein in general, but in particular the Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung reached 1 million subscribers already before World War I. So this is much more widely read than any daily newspaper. And the brains behind this is an interesting character named Kurt Koff, who writes very nice pieces about what's really going on in Berlin culture of the day. So he's really trying to reach the masses with a kind of new media of somehow the images are dominant here. You write around the pictures and so forth. The texts are really not that important. It's these pictures. Interestingly enough, if I imagine most people here know Life magazine fairly well, and he goes and starts up, he's a founding figure for Life magazine when he has to leave Germany in 1933. And so this image of the new Copernicus that appears in the Berliner Illustrierte Zeitung is really of massive importance, and it's not just an accidental thing. It's part of a whole strategy of putting out images and talking about them in interesting ways. Here is that famous picture, and let me read you just a little bit of the text surrounding it, just so that you get the flavor. In the year 1543, a new chapter began in human thought and understanding, indeed in the entire development of humanity. This is the little mini history of science that they're going to give you here. This was brought about by the publication of one simple book, De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium. I think the first time I've ever heard that called a simple book. The work of Nicolaus Copernicus. Newton's law of gravitation became only a special case of Einstein's theory of relativity. Our notions of space and time must be changed to accord with Einstein's theories. And just as before in Copernicus's time, a change in our image of the world has once again come about. A new epoch in human history has now arisen, and it is indissolubly bound with the name of Albert Einstein. Well, this particular piece was written about in the day by Rudolf Kaiser. And let me just show you what he says about it. Hundreds of thousands of people saw this face for the first time, heard for the first time the name of this Berlin professor of physics, learned for the first time through the printed article about the problems of the theory of relativity, And in all probability, his face made as deep an impression on the readers as the popular and abbreviated summary of his great discoveries. That's a quotation from a biography of Einstein written by Anton Reiser, that's the pseudonym for Rudolf Kaiser, in 1930. Rudolf Kaiser isn't just nobody, he's a well-known literary critic and essayist, writes about interesting themes of the day, Neue Sachlichkeit, Amerikanismus. He is the editor of Die Neue Rundschau, a very important literary publication of the day. Later he writes biographies of Spinoza and Yehuda Halevi. And here's Die Neue Rundschau and the founding publisher, Samuel Fischer. So this is, again, a whole other genre of things appearing in Weimar at this time. And here's a picture of Rudolf and Kaiser with his wife, Ilse. So now you get the connection with Einstein, I think. Not everybody gets to go out on Einstein's boat. And so here's Rudy and here's Ilse. She is Elsa Einstein's oldest daughter, and she's also Einstein's first secretary. And they both play an interesting role later in 1933 in removing the Einstein papers from the office of what was then the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physics, that is the upper apartment of his upper floor of his apartment, removing those things to Paris in 1933. That's the location of this Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, where Ilse Einstein worked for many years. So we're in very intimate terms when we read about things in that biography from 1930. It's quite clear they're nearly coming right from Einstein's mouth. This is someone with whom he met very, very regularly, part of the family. Now, just a word very quickly here. I see I'm just about out of time, but let me just factor in the politics a little bit. There's the anti-relativity movement, and here you see a sort of collector of the day, Ernst Gerke, a leading experimental physicist. He also liked to collect little cutouts from the newspapers of the time. A wonderful source, then, if you want to see how are people reacting to Einstein. And he publishes some of this stuff in this booklet from 1924, where you get to see such little thought experiments in the Weinstube, but this is part of this connection then with the anti-Semitism of the time, when in August of 1920, Paul Weiland starts this campaign against Einstein. So Gerke is one of those behind that. It plays on these famous anti-Semitic images, knife in the back legend and so forth. Here, the sort of reaction to that from the day, a plea to German mothers about who have lost their to have sympathy with Jewish mothers who lost their sons in the war, and this typical sort of anti-Semitic imagery. So Einstein reacts to this big time in Berliner Tageblatt. This is what really politicizes his whole situation in Berlin, in this article right here, charging his opponents with anti-Semitism and so forth, provoking a huge rift in the German physics community when he writes, "I am fully aware that the speakers on this occasion are unworthy of a reply from my pen, for I have good reason to believe that there are other motives behind this undertaking than the search for truth. Were I a German national, whether bearing swastika or not, rather than a Jew of liberal and international bent," and then he just leaves that hanging. So this, of course, causes a scandal. There's a similar sort of thing that happens in France, where someone writes during Einstein's trip to France in 1922, "I don't understand Einstein's equations. All I know is that the Dreyfus adherents claim he's a genius, whereas the Dreyfus opponents say he is an ass." And the remarkable thing is that although the Dreyfus affair has long been forgotten, the same groups line up and face each other at the slightest provocation. So the politicization of the period is very clear, and Einstein visits these battle sites. This is then published in the pro-relativity illustrated papers of the day, whereas in Deutsche Tagezeitung, Johannes Stark, one of the most vociferous critics of Einstein writes, "Seen from Einstein's personal standpoint, this trip to France is completely understandable. After all, he characterized himself as a pacifist Jew of German citizenship with international sympathies. He must therefore lack the feeling of a German toward the French oppressors." Well, I'm just about out of time here, so let me just summarize. How does Einstein react to all of this stuff? This is a quote from, he's in New York, in fact, on this trip from 1921. How does he see this? "To some degree, the phenomenon of anti-Semitism in Germany is based on the fact that Jews exert an influence on the intellectual life of the German people altogether out of proportion to their numbers. While in my opinion, the economic position of the German Jews is vastly overestimated, Jewish influence on the press, literature, and science in Germany is very pronounced and obvious to even the casual observer. The attitude toward my theory adopted by English science and the press has been characteristic. In Germany, for the most part, a newspaper's political orientation dictated its judgment of my theory. The attitude of English scientists, on the other hand, demonstrated that their sense of objectivity is not clouded by a political point of view." So here I think you can see from this little clip of reactions in different cultures and so forth, how politicized all of this stuff was. The fact that this theory was confirmed right after World War I, as the Versailles Treaty was kicking in and so forth, led to major tensions, and these really go all the way through. It's not just popular culture, they enter into the scientific community and lead to all kinds of problems there. And of course, this will pop up again after 1933 as well. But let me end there. Thank you.
Thank you, David. We have time just for a couple of quick questions. If anybody has a question, if you'd like to raise your hand and wait for the microphone to arrive.
Did Einstein enjoy his notoriety, or did he look at it as an obligation?
The notoriety specifically. The adulation or the notoriety or both? Because there are two aspects to that.
Did he enjoy being a public figure, or did he look at it as his responsibility to, because of his fame, and he had a responsibility to his...
Well, if you heard Robert Schumann's talk this morning, he addressed this pretty straight on, that Einstein's fundamental take is actually independence. He seeks he wants the freedom to do his science and so forth. He's not really fundamentally interested in political issues, and certainly not fame in the sense that it came. However, the circumstances of the day were highly politicized, and as Robert pointed out, there were all the moral issues that Einstein felt he couldn't avoid, in particular because he was the most prominent Jew of the day, and the situation with the East European Jews, etc., was anti-Semitism in general was such a big theme. This forever actually changes his attitude about politics and who he is and everything. So I think the short answer to your question is no, he didn't seek it out, or it wasn't something he fundamentally desired. However, he stepped up when he felt it was necessary to act in special circumstances, and that explains, I think, most of the political things he engages in.
Question here?
Yes, hello. I know that Hilbert gave some very strong comments throughout his life when he felt that there was an injustice. Did he make any comments about Einstein's being forced to depart?
Yes, well, that's interesting that you bring that up, because there are these famous lectures that
famous lectures that Einstein gives in Göttingen when he first meets Hilbert in 1915, and he writes to several people how excited he is by Hilbert in wartime. And it's simply this independence again. He's an internationalist. The Göttingen community is very open. And so a political alliance of a type develops between the two of them. Of course, they have the famous competition in general relativity. But what seems to interest Einstein at the time even more than these things is the politics of the day, the academic politics and how that plays out. So during these years, you see quite a bit of back and forth there. And he felt that Hilbert was one of the few German academics who stood up strongly for internationalism and these sorts of values. So glad you asked that question.
I think what's particularly instructive for creative scientists today is to know to the extent that it's possible and to the extent that historians of science can contribute to this, is how scientists historically went about constructing, creating their ideas, and what they might have been about the worldview that might have contributed. For example, Newton did more writing in the area of mysticism, yes, I believe, than in science. So this indicated an openness to concepts beyond what are currently accepted in existing science. Einstein supposedly talked with voices, although I haven't seen that in too many places. It wasn't just one of his wives whispering in his ear. For example, the dream state can make a contribution to developing a new idea. I found myself in studying physics many years ago that when I had a particularly difficult problem, if I used the state between waking and dreaming, I could often come up with a solution that otherwise wouldn't necessarily be there. So there are attitudes of mind, ways to conduct the scientific method, if you like, that go beyond the norm that can contribute to originality of ideas.
Thank you. I would just comment that in the case of Einstein, there is a sort of interesting interplay between the various components, if you will, of scientific creativity that go on. So he addresses this and he moves in various different directions. The young Einstein, I mentioned Mach in this talk. I mean, he's very influenced by certain trends in science of the day, where Mach was a big figure, but he drifts more and more away from that with general relativity, and he feels more guided by mathematical ideas and things of this sort. So he's someone who's open, actually, to all kinds of ideas from all kinds of directions. He's terribly unorthodox in that respect. And I think one of the clues to his creativity as a scientist, but even in public life too, is he's not dogmatic. So Einstein will pursue a problem with a set of ideas and he'll pursue it tenaciously. But the moment he's convinced that that's not going anywhere, he gives it up and he'll move on to the next idea. So he does this in physics all over the place.
We'll take one last question here, please.
Very, very interesting talk. Thank you. I've looked at the U.S. situation in the 20s among astronomers, and you can see a lot of the anti-relativity, National Socialism motivated anti-relativity, being quoted by astronomers who don't like relativity. And have you looked at the U.S. situation?
A little bit, yeah.
Because the difference I noticed is, in Germany, there were people who understood the theory. Yeah. In the U.S., there was no one.
Yeah.
And a lot of the debate and the rhetoric was influenced by the fact that no one could explain the theory and no one could understand it.
Yeah. Well, I can comment just a little bit about the U.S. situation. So Einstein comes to the United States in 1921, and that's when he gives these famous Princeton lectures, which are published today as The Meaning of Relativity. And he meets Oswald Veblen and Eisenhardt, this differential geometer is there and so forth. And there are these mathematicians, typically mathematicians and astronomers are the ones who are going after these ideas back then. Another big name is Birkhoff, G.D. Birkhoff, who publishes a book on relativity and does some interesting work in 1922. So there are experts on this sort of thing, but I think you're absolutely right that in the main, they're a very tiny group. And the anti-relativists have more of a quack sort of a background, I guess you'd say. They're part of an international network, though. They all cite one another and so forth, and they know one another. And then the political thing comes into play, too, because there is a connection with Henry Ford and the Dearborn Independent and so forth. That's a very well-documented, sorry chapter in American cultural history. And so there's a fellow named Reuterdahl, who's an obscure Minnesota figure, and he has a column in the Dearborn Independent that he publishes diatribes against relativity theory and so forth. So a handful of American figures and so forth, too, but I would fundamentally agree with your assessment of it. Yeah.
David, on that note, I'd like to thank you very much again for your lecture this afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and please exit at the top of the stairs on that side of the theater. Thank you.